Are we ready to start now?
Sure.
Did you say sure?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sure. All right. So hope everybody's doing well. I don't have as good of a background as some of you do. This is my son's room, so it's less interesting for sure. I want to start where we left off last time, and just as a reminder, that's not what I'm going to do first. I just remembered that for Sunday's class, I said that if anyone had questions, I could answer them at the beginning of the class now. So did anybody have any questions about what was discussed for Sunday morning? Okay, I take that as a no. If questions do come up about last class, maybe something I say jogs your memory, then I'm happy to answer them at that point too. But I do want to start then where we left off. If I can find the slides, this is the only thing I don't like about this screen share. It's always different where the PowerPoint slides are, always different. So there it is, I found it. Okay, so just to summarize what we've talked about so far in Hebrews, we've talked about the superiority of Jesus over the prophets, over the angels, and over Moses. The first two have to do with revelation, but the superiority of Jesus over Moses has to do with the fact that he was a son, whereas Moses was a servant. They were both faithful in God's house, to use the language that he uses, but Jesus was superior because he was the son. Then, if you remember, there's this admonition to not be like the wilderness generation. We talked about that in the last two classes, about why that generation in particular is zeroed in on, if you will, because they had firsthand seen the miracles that God had performed in Egypt during the course of the Exodus. But he says in a couple of different places, I think, that don't, just because of their unique experience, don't assume that those lessons aren't applicable to us, right? So I made that point several times too. And then last time on Sunday, we talked more about what it means when he says, let us strive to enter God's Sabbath rest. And then the last point from last time is what he says at the end of chapter 4, and this launches him into the discussion of 5, and then after 5, but that's because Jesus is high priest. That's what enables us to partake of God's Sabbath rest. But obviously, if he says here, let us strive to enter God's Sabbath rest, the implication, of course, is that we can lose it. We can fail to enter God's Sabbath rest because of something that we do. And I think that's going to come up in a much, much stronger fashion in chapter 6, which is where I plan to go today. So again, I want to remind you of the argument of Hebrews. In the last days, God has spoken to his son. He's superior to all the things that I mentioned earlier. And then now we're in this section of the text where he talks about Jesus as being a high priest. But there are some significant differences between Jesus being a high priest and a Levitical high priest. So here we see that Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. He's superior to the Old Testament priest because he's mediator of a better covenant based on better promises, and he gave a better sacrifice. And then we have the final section there. So that is this section, and this general idea about the high priesthood of Jesus is where the Hebrew writer spends a tremendous amount of time, or maybe we should say space, in the work. All right, so let's now look at chapter 5. Again, we started this last time, but I want to pick this up again. So remember that argument. Remember what he said before. You need to strive to enter the Sabbath rest. You could do that because Jesus is a high priest. And then it's almost like he says, oh, yeah, speaking of the fact that Jesus is high priest, then now I have a few things to say about that. So he says, every priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward since he himself is beset with weakness. Then he mentions in verse 3, he's got to offer sacrifices for his own sins. Now, I want to say this again because I mentioned this before, but I think this is a really I guess you could say intricate argument that he makes, because remember earlier he says Jesus is a high priest with whom we can find sympathy because he's walked in our shoes yet without sin. Now he's saying these human high priests can sympathize with the worshipers for a different reason, because they have actually sinned and they need to offer a sacrifice for sins. So I think that's a very interesting argument. And then he says, Christ was appointed as high priest by God. And then we get to verse 6, where he says, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And this is where you would expect him to really launch into some details about Melchizedek, because when he brings this up, when we understand what little is said about Melchizedek, then I don't think we can expect the readers to say, oh yeah, of course, Jesus is a high priest after Melchizedek. That makes complete sense. We know exactly what he's saying. No, I don't think that. And I think that's why he has a much more detailed exposition about that subject later on. But let's now look at these passages which talk about Melchizedek. Can anybody tell me how many passages total in the Old Testament Melchizedek is mentioned? Anybody know what that is? Okay, so somebody said 3, somebody said 2. The answer is 2 total mentions of Melchizedek in the Old Testament. So 2 is correct. Now look at the first one, Genesis 14, 18 through 20. This is when Melchizedek meets Abraham. I don't know any other way to describe this. This is a mysterious passage. Maybe I'll explain myself a little bit in a minute. Maybe not, but no, I will. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. He blessed him and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. So that's it. Now, I was specific when I said how many times does the occur in the entire Old Testament, because the answer is 2, but how many times does he occur in the Old Testament narrative? This is it right here. This is all we have. And as I said, it's a bit mysterious because it's almost like he walks on stage just for a few seconds and then he walks off stage never to be heard from again. In the narrative. I mean, I can't really think of an analogy quite like this. Maybe Enoch, but I don't even think Enoch quite reaches this level of just, it's just surprising what happens here. So what happens in this passage? Well, or let me back up. What can we learn about Melchizedek from this passage? Okay, he's king of Salem. He brings out bread and wine. He's priest of God Most High. He blesses Abraham, and then Abram gives him a tenth of everything. That's it. Now, the other mysterious thing about this is if you take these verses out of Genesis 14 and just keep reading, the narrative makes complete sense. So I'm just fascinated by that, I really don't have a great explanation as to why someone who proves to be so very important in Hebrews, as we will see, is mentioned here and then in one other place. I just find that to be pretty surprising. Does anyone else have any comments about this so far? Okay, well, let's look at the other reference then in the Old Testament to Melchizedek, and that's Psalm 110. Okay, now I think I've already mentioned this probably more than once, but I think it's worth mentioning that more than once. Obviously, if it's worth mentioning that many times, well, if it's not, I shouldn't do it. But anyway, whatever. It's the most quoted passage in the New Testament from the Old Testament. And a quotation, I should probably be a little bit more accurate about that. It's the most quoted and or alluded to passage in the New Testament. I mean, think about that. You might think, well, it's Psalm 22 or it's Isaiah 53. No, it's Psalm 110. So here we have the text. Remember when you see Lord in all capital letters in the Old Testament, that stands for Yahweh. Yahweh says to my Lord. Now notice, this is important because this is an argument that's made elsewhere in the New Testament on this very point. And if you don't understand that Lord in all capital letters means it's the divine name Yahweh, this can be confusing. So he's saying Yahweh says to my Lord. The Hebrew word for Lord there, it's not capitalized, it's Adonai. So Yahweh says to Adonai, my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Yahweh sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power and holy garments from the womb of the morning. The dew of yours will be yours. Okay, now if we stop there, you can say, all right, what is this psalm about? You say, okay, it's a royal psalm. I mean, you know, he mentions scepter, he mentions Zion, he mentions the enemies being the footstool. I mean, all that's royal imagery that you find elsewhere, particularly in the Psalms, but other places too. That's easy, right? I don't think that's difficult. But verses 4 and 5, particularly 4, is again, it's mysterious, it's strange, surprising. Yahweh has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings of the day, on the day of his wrath. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now think, now we have to deal with a couple of things here. First of all, the audience of the psalm. Right now, one of the questions that we have about the Psalms is how were they actually used by ancient Israel? Now, the most obvious answer is, well, they're used in worship, right? And that's certainly correct. But were they specifically in what worship setting were they used? And like I said, this certainly sounds like a royal psalm. Maybe it was used at the ceremony to coronate the king, a new king, perhaps. That's, I think, a good possibility. But we just don't know a whole lot about that process. So however it was used, could you imagine the ancient Israelites hearing that phrase, you're a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek? I mean, I think they would have been just as surprised as we are by this, and maybe a little perplexed just as we are. Now the question becomes, well, would the original audience of the book of Hebrews been more familiar with Melchizedek? And that is a good question, because Melchizedek is mentioned in extra biblical literature, but not a whole lot. And when he is mentioned, it's fragmentary. So there's I think a couple of fragments among the Dead Sea Scrolls where he's mentioned, but exactly what role he's playing is very difficult to determine because the text is fragmentary. In other words, you have a fragment, but you also have a lot of tiny pieces. And so you have to figure out how do these pieces fit together to make this text meaningful. And scholars, as you might imagine, disagree quite a bit about that subject. So we don't know what the original audience would have understood about Melchizedek. Were they, are they in the dark as much as we are at this point? I can't say. I don't know. But the thing is, he doesn't leave it there, right? If he left it there, it would be as mysterious as these Old Testament passages, right? But he doesn't. He picks it up, particularly in chapter 7. And in fact, that section of the text, beginning here at 5:1, continuing on through chapter 10, some have argued that that is largely just a commentary on Psalm 110. And the Genesis 14 passage as well. Matt, I think that's probably going a bit too far. I think he's doing more than just simply commenting on the text, but that shows you just how influenced by Psalm 110 the writer is. Okay, so that is the introduction to Melchizedek. And I could have waited to really go into this, because he doesn't go into this in detail right now. There's like an interlude before chapter 7, and that brings up a question how these chapters work together, 5, 6, and 7, and we'll look at that in just a minute. But before we do that, before we look at the rest of chapter 5, does anyone have any questions or comments at this point? Okay, let's continue then. In chapter 5, verse 7, we have more information about Jesus the high priest. In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, there are some things here that could take us a little bit far afield, I think, from why he mentions these two verses. I think he's mentioning these verses because he's re-emphasizing what he's already mentioned about the Son. And so that idea of Jesus as the Son seems to be not far from the Hebrew writer's mind very much at all. Remember, that was why he compared him to Moses, and why Jesus was superior to Moses, because he was a son and Moses wasn't a son as Jesus was. So here he's saying, all right, well, what exactly does that mean? Well, it means that in the days of his flesh, and I think we can figure out that that means when Jesus walked the earth, he offered up prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. That word piety, I was talking to somebody at one point, I don't remember, it's been a while now, but they thought piety had a negative connotation, and maybe it does in the way that it's sometimes used in English. But here, obviously, it doesn't mean anything negative. It's really like devotion to God, something like that. So, so this is talking about Jesus when he was on earth. He offers up prayers and supplications to God, who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his piety. Now, when you look at the New Testament, and you look at the crucifixion accounts and what happens after that, I think it matches this pretty well. You know, we think about what happened in the garden, and maybe that is what the Hebrew writer has in mind here. He doesn't explicitly say that. But did God hear his prayer because of his piety? Yes, he did. Okay, so I'm trying to think how to say this, because I think it's a very important point, and I think this passage sheds light on it, but it's also a controversial idea. So I just want to, so I'll say it this way. You know, sometimes when we talk about the Lord's Supper, we talk about how that in that moment, God turns his back on Jesus, right? Sometimes I think that when we put that a certain way, it bothers me a little bit. And I think it's problematic. And we don't have to go into why. I just think that instead of automatically assuming that's how things went down, that's how things happened, consider these verses. Do these verses have anything to say about that? And I would argue that they do. That's all I want to say about that. If you want to talk about that, you know, some other time, I'm happy to do it, because I do have some thoughts about that. But you know, that's all I want to say. Just consider these verses. Maybe you still think that that's actually what occurred. Okay, that's fine. But I do want these verses certainly to be part of that discussion, because when I've talked to people, I find that they're really not. But anyway, enough about that. Maybe. All right, so Jesus is made perfect, and perfection is something that you find discussed in Hebrews very, very often as well. And he becomes the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. And then we come back to verse 10. So now twice in two verses, he mentions Melchizedek. And so as readers, we expect him in verse 11 to just really start talking about, all right, how are you comparing Jesus and Melchizedek specifically? What do you mean when you do that? But he's not quite ready to do that just yet, because before that, he has these four verses. Now, these verses are difficult, because it sounds like the Hebrew writer is saying, you guys aren't ready for this, okay? You're not ready to hear what I have to say about Jesus and Melchizedek. You can't handle it. But after 5 and then an interlude in chapter 6, he goes ahead and talks about it, okay? So I think probably means we should ask the question, what is he doing rhetorically here? What is he trying to accomplish by saying what he does here? So he says about this, and I think that this here probably refers to the subject of the high priesthood of Jesus in light of Melchizedek. It's hard to explain, since you have become dull of hearing. I think verse 11 may indicate an answer to that question about, well, how much more would they have understood about Melchizedek? I think maybe verse 11 sheds some light on that, well, maybe they didn't have much more information than we did. But at any rate, verse 12, though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic principles, the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is not accustomed to the word of righteousness. He's an infant. Solid food is for the mature, who because of practice have their senses trained to discern good and evil. Now, the thing is, we would expect him now to talk about some of these, you know, some of this milk, right? It's very basic teachings, but he just mentions them in passing. So I think rhetorically, what he's probably doing here is he's wanting them to say, no, wait a minute. No, we're not. We're beyond that. We can handle it. So I think he just is perhaps planting it in their mind, the idea in their mind that, maybe you really need to think. Are you where you need to be? Are you in a situation where you could teach, or you are teaching? But he says you need someone to teach you again the basic principles. This concept of milk representing basic teaching is very common in philosophy, talking about different levels of education. So you have milk, you have solid food. You find this in Philo of Alexandria, for example, and also Epictetus, who's a Stoic philosopher, who's actually writing about the same time the Hebrew writer is. So it's very, very common. Now, the reason I bring that up is because some people have said, no, wait a minute. He uses the same analogy Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 3. Now, Paul does it a little bit differently, because Paul, I think, is clearly saying, this is how you guys are. Here in Hebrews, I think he's doing something slightly different. But some people have said, okay, well, Paul says it in 1 Corinthians 3. Now we have it in Hebrews 5:11 and following. So maybe that reinforces the idea that Apollos wrote the work. But as I've already said, I don't think that's a legitimate conclusion, because this is very commonplace in ancient philosophy. So I don't think that really helps anything as far as that argument is concerned. Okay, I know I've said a lot, so I want to see, do we have any questions or comments here? Would anybody like to add anything? Now, see, I don't know what this means. I don't know if this means that. I don't know what it means. But I'll just assume that everyone's just want me to keep going, and they don't really want to say anything. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But okay. Well, if there's nothing further, then let's go on and talk about 5, 6, and 7 and how they relate, because I think I've already indicated this to some extent that, you know, he starts talking about this Melchizedek subject in chapter 5. And like I said, you expect him to continue it, but he doesn't. Chapter 6, he talks about an enormously important subject, and then he begins the discussion of Melchizedek. This is how I think they relate to each other. You have to remember, we have to read Hebrews much more like a written version of a sermon than we do the Pauline epistles, for example. Paul's epistles are not sermons. They're not sermon outlines. They are epistles. Now, admittedly, when the congregation, let's say at Corinth, received a letter from Paul, they would have had someone stand before them and read it. And there was certainly, I'm pretty sure, certainly a performative aspect to that, which could certainly sometimes resemble preaching. But that's not what I mean. Hebrews is much more like a sermon. And so we could imagine that on occasion he's going to stop maybe with the subject matter and say, no, wait a minute, let's think about us. Let's think about your own situation. And let's think about a very important issue related to this specific issue. I kind of think that's how they all work together. So let's now look specifically at how these relate together. Chapter 5, we've already talked about, of course, Christ is a high priest, different than the Levitical high priest, because he's a priest after the order of Melchizedek. But this is admittedly a difficult teaching. This is hard to understand. And you ought to be in a position where you can understand it, but are you? Are you really there? Because if you're not, then that could mean you're spiritually stagnant, chapter 6 now. And spiritual stagnation can eventually lead to a state where repentance is impossible. That's the word he uses, as of course we will see. And then chapter 7, he comes back to that subject. All right. Here, I'll give it to you, the similarities of Jesus and Melchizedek. I think that's how these chapters work together. So I hope that makes sense. Okay, so let's now get into chapter 6. And I've already said this at least twice, but I want to say it again. Remember the artificiality of the chapter divisions. Well, here again, we have that in chapter 6. And again, that is not a criticism of whoever made these chapter divisions. There's a story about Erasmus of Rotterdam, who supposedly made some of the chapter divisions in the New Testament while he was riding on horseback. I don't know about that. I'm pretty dubious of that, story, but and I think a lot of times they're pretty good. They make sense. And it makes sense here. I'm just saying that the chapter division between chapter 5 and chapter 6 here might lead one to think, okay, he's moving on to something else. No, not really. It's very much related to chapter 5. And I think that's why it's important to look at how 5, 6, and 7 relate to each other. So he says, therefore, let us move beyond the elementary teachings about Christ. Okay, are you spiritually behind where you need to be? Are you sure about that? He says, okay, well, maybe you're questioning yourselves. And if you think that you are, well, let's move beyond that. Let's go past that. Let's look forward to maturity, not laying again the foundation of repentance from acts that lead to death and a faith in God, instruction about cleansing rites, or washings, as some translations say, the laying on of hands, the resurrection of the dead, and eternal judgment. And God permitting, we will do so. And that's an indication that he is going to go back to something that's beyond what he says are the elementary teachings about Christ. Now, what's bizarre about this is that the elementary teachings that he mentions may not necessarily accord with all of them that we would state, right? If someone said, okay, what are the elementary teachings? What are the first principles about Christianity? We would have some of these in there for sure, but not all of them. And the ones that we wouldn't have certainly require some explanation. Some commentators think that he may be using a sort of formula that was given from Jewish Christians to Gentile Christians. And so some of these practices have a Jewish foundation. I don't know about that. Some of these are difficult to be sure. Just one thing about this, when he says elementary teachings about Christ, some translations will go more literally and say of Christ, but there's some ambiguity here in the Greek where it could be the teachings that Christ himself spoke, or it could be the teachings about Christ. And that's the interpretation that this translation goes with. And I mean, you know, in a case like this, does it really matter? Not a whole lot, right? Not in this context, but just to let you know that explains some of the differences in translations here. So, all right. He says repentance from acts that lead to death. Later on in Hebrews, I think it's chapter 9, he says that this is talking about sin. All right. So I think that's pretty easy to figure out. These acts that lead to death are sinful activities. All right. That makes perfect sense. Faith in God, perfect sense. Right. And now we know from chapter 11, which is, I would assume, the most well-known chapter in the entire book. That's the Faith's Hall of Fame chapter, which, by the way, one of the things that I hope to accomplish in this class is to ask the question, why is chapter 11 there anyway? I mean, as great as the passage is, and it is great, there's a reason that it's the most well-known chapter in Hebrews, at least it seems to me. Well, why is that? Well, again, because it's wonderful. But how does it fit within Hebrews? Okay, so we'll answer that question later. But my point here is when he says faith in God, we know that the Hebrew writer's definition of faith is more than simply acknowledging the existence of God. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about something much more than that. And let's talk about that for a second, because I think that is an area where you might have something to add, for sure. And that is, you know, we talk about faith so much, and I was thinking about this the other day, that I really don't think it's difficult for people to believe in a creator, to believe that there was some being who started all this, right? I don't think that's difficult. And I think when we look at the history of humanity in general, we see that the vast majority of human beings have believed that, okay? I don't think that's difficult. But when we become more specific about it, that's when the difficulties come in, and that's where people are lost, right? When we say God created the universe by his words, he spoke it into existence, you're going to have people say, oh, come on. You know, come on. When we say, okay, there's a creator God, but he sent his son, Jesus, to die on the cross for our sins, and he was raised the third day, people say, nope, I can't believe in that. Okay. So when we see the word faith, I would say in most cases in the New Testament, it means more than the simple intellectual acknowledgement of God's existence. And by the way, I don't think that's going to be surprising to anybody listening to this, but I do think it's worth pointing out here for sure, because it's something that could certainly get lost if we're not careful. Does anyone have anything to add about that? Because, you know, we don't have time to go into everything he mentions here, but since it is so foundational, I think it's worth asking, all right, well, what exactly does he mean about this foundational topic, faith in God? And I think that's what he means, much more so than just intellectual acknowledgement that there is a creator. Anything else about that? Okay. Well, was that me or was that somebody else?
No, I was going to ask a question.
Yeah.
All right. So how does that, him mentioning faith, how does that relate back to his kind of argument in chapter 4 and verse 2 about the generation that didn't enter the promised land, and it was because they had heard the good news, and yet it was not united in faith.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because that takes into account what he says about faith, as you mentioned elsewhere, and specifically there, I think that's actually maybe a better verse to use than chapter 11, even for this point, because that generation, as we've talked about many times, had all the evidence before them. And I mean, did the wilderness generation disbelieve that God existed? No, of course not. But they disbelieved, I think, it at least this, many other things probably, but they disbelieved at least that God would fail to keep his promises that he made them about entering the land. So yeah, that's a great example of how faith in God, faith in his power, even that's not enough. We have to have faith in what he's promised, and I think we can find many other passages about that too. Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm glad you brought that up. All right, let's try to finish these couple of verses up. And I think verse 2, when it says instruction about cleansing rites, this word sometimes is translated washings. Some translations may go with baptisms, because this is a cognate of the word that's usually translated baptism. But most translations will go with cleansings or washings. And that's why I think, and I think that's legitimate. I think that could, again, point to the fact that this may have some Jewish origin, that he points that out. Other than that, I'm not sure. The laying on of hands could be, we know that's used in many places in the New Testament, other than simply the transferal of miracles or even performing miracles, resurrection of the dead, which is easy to understand. And that could also be a Jewish belief, because if you recall, that was a common belief among many Jews. It seems like the Pharisees, for example, believed strongly in the resurrection of the dead, and then eternal judgment, also very much a Jewish belief. So I say that as a possibility, but other than that, I'm just not sure. All right, I think that's a good place to stop tonight. But I still have some time if people want to ask questions or add anything, because I feel like I've done way too much talking tonight. I don't know if you agree, but that's what I think anyway.
Hey, Dr. Dilbeck.
Yeah.
I remember from class you talked about in 11.1 when it says assurance that maybe a better translation might be reality or like objective reality.
Yeah, right.
Talking about like they didn't, like the wilderness generation didn't have faith that they believed in God, but they didn't believe the promises would become a reality. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, I think that's true for sure. Yeah, I think that is true. That like I said, it was enough that they saw God performing the miracles. And there, I mean, to witness those things, there's no way they could disbelieve in God's power, in God's ability to disrupt what we would refer to as the laws of nature, right? I mean, that's what he does in the Exodus narrative. But yeah, the substantial reality, like you mentioned from chapter 11, verse 1, I think they couldn't believe that. If it wasn't something that they witnessed with their own eyes, they couldn't believe it. And again, I think that idea is just as relevant for us, if not more so, because we live in such a more skeptical society and a much more scientifically influenced society, whether we realize it or not. Sometimes, and so it's probably even more relevant for us. So, yeah, that's a good question. Somebody, okay. Well, I'm not gonna beg anybody. That's for sure. But if you do have questions, you can bring them up. Well, I was going to say Sunday, but I don't guess that'll work for Sunday. But you can email me if you have questions, specific questions, and I'll be happy to answer those. So please feel free to do that. If you're not super comfortable doing that. There is one question here, though. Would you think that because the author of Hebrews mentions Melchizedek along with angels and Abraham, he's demonstrated that Jesus is better than the best of all angelic beings, better than the greatest patriarch, and better than even the most revered priest the audience knew at the time? That's a really good point, and that's a good possibility, maybe. The only question I would have would be the last thing, the most revered priest the audience knew. Well, I mean, do we know that for sure? And I would just say we really don't. But is it possible? Yeah, it is possible. And I think if that's not exactly how they saw it, it's pretty close. So I think that's very well put. And like you said, better than the superstars of their day. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Exactly. Okay. Anybody else? I can't tell if somebody's getting the courage up to ask a question or if that just means it's about time to stop.
Okay. Oh, Will, this is, do you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Oh, all right. Hi, this is Catherine Murphy here. And going back to faith in God.
Yeah.
When you said that means so much more, I'm thinking of that passage in Hebrews where it says that he promised never to leave us or forsake us. And I'm thinking of that in reference to, the realm of things that are going on in the world right now with the pandemic and how people, some are questioning, you know, where is God at this time when so many things are going on and so many people are dying. And folks can't even find masks. And those who are in the hospitals and there with the sick and trying to do their jobs as best they can, but they don't have the basic tools that they need to protect themselves so that they can remain strong and healthy physically to do their job to help those who are hurting at this time. And for us as Christians, faith in God for us is meaning we know that God is here And I think Josh touched on that a little bit Sunday when he was talking about Daniel and some of his lesson. God is always present. He is always here for us, and he is always taking care of us and providing for us what we need. And our wants, and I'm thinking perspective, our wants are different from our needs. But when it comes to faith in God, like you mentioned, that encompasses so much, so much more. And I call, you mentioned that when we tell people, yes, God sent his only son. Yes, and he died on the cross for our sins. And some people don't want to believe that. But then I think about that passage in the scripture that says, it's foolishness of preaching to them. It's foolishness to the world because they don't have the discernment, I think. And that's all I'd like to say about that right now.
Well, I mean, yeah, that I don't think I can add anything to that. I think that those are great comments for sure and very relevant. So yeah, I mean, we're seeing something happening all over the world, which I think will cause some people to question God, question their own faith. And is it easy to have the answers? No, it's not. But that's where faith comes in. Do we know exactly what's happening? Do we know why God's allowed? No, I don't. And I certainly can't pretend to have those answers. But I believe he does. And I believe that there's much more about it than we could understand. And, you know, sometimes I hear people say, well, we'll get those answers one day. Well, is it going to be okay if we don't? So, again, that's not really a relevant comment. But, yeah, that was very well said and very relevant. I did get another question here about the cleansing rites in Hebrews 6 and verse 2. If that's supposed to be an elementary teaching, what are we supposed to do with it today? Which is a very good question. Again, I think he's just discussing in passing what would be considered by some maybe in that particular congregation to be elementary teaching. I don't think he's necessarily saying this is the elementary teaching of Christians for all time necessarily, even though many of them have an analog. And by the way, if he would have just simply had baptism singular, we wouldn't have a problem with any of it, I don't think. But, I mean, we would ask the same question about laying on of hands if he's meaning it in some miraculous way also. So, again, I'm not entirely sure. But that's what I think. He's not laying down once and for all what are elementary principles in every situation. I think he's saying, according to some of you, these are elementary principles, and you still need to be studying them. I think that's what he's getting at. I hope that makes sense. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Well, we've gone over, I hope that's okay. I thought the comments and questions that were made afterward were very helpful. So I have no problem with that. I hope it was okay with you. All right. Well, like I said, if there are other questions that we didn't really get to, please feel free to send me an email or text. I think everybody's probably got that, and I'll be happy to answer them. All right. Appreciate your attention, and we'll see you next time, virtually. We'll see you next time. Thank you guys for setting all this up, too, by the way.